Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from Treasury of Great Short Stories, published by Amaranth Press. The Reunion by Margaret Drabble. There must have been a moment at which she decided to go down the street and round the corner and into the cafe. She knew that, for she knew that at one point she was walking quite idly, quite innocently, with no recollection or association in her head, but the dimmest, faintest, palest shadow of long, long past knowledge, and that within 10 yards, 20 yards perhaps, of innocence, the distance of two frontages of those ancient, crumbling, small, tall buildings, now so uniformly shoddy warehouses, she had made up her mind that she would go and have her lunch there, in that place where they had always had their lunch together. Or no, she said to herself, not even always, excusing herself, apologetic, already diminishing any possible significance of her act. They had not had their lunch there always. They had had it there merely occasionally, once a fortnight or so, over that long and lovely year, and the first time that they had gone there had had no significance at all. For it was simply that, being in such an area they did not know very well, they had had lunch in the only place that they could find. And they had liked it there, and so they had gone back, because it was the kind of place where nobody would ever see them, where nobody that either of them knew would ever go, and yet at the same time not impossibly inconvenient, not so very far from Holborn, where they both had good reason from time to time to be. They had felt safe there, as safe as they could ever feel, yet at the same time aware that they had not allowed themselves to be driven into grotesque precautions. They had found it themselves so much by chance, and they did not think that anyone they knew could chance to walk that way. And now, after so long, after a 3-year gap, she had found herself there, and almost as it were upon the threshold, and at lunchtime too. She was hungry. There's nothing more to it than that, she said to herself, as she found herself walking so instinctively toward it. I happened to be near and wanting my lunch, and the fact that I wanted my lunch merely reminded me of this place, and that I did curiously enough know it was here, and moreover that there is nowhere else possible within a 5 minutes' walk. She had done enough walking, she thought. She had never liked walking. It had been enough of a walk, from Old Street Tube Station to the place where they had made her new tooth. She ran her tongue over her new front tooth, reassuringly, and was slightly ashamed by the immense relief that she felt at being once more presentable, no longer disfigured by that humiliating gap. Being beautiful, she had always made much of caring little for her beauty, and was always profoundly disturbed by the accidents which from time to time brought her face to face with her own vanity, by the inconvenient pimple, by the unperceived smudge on the cheek, by the heavy cold. And that lost tooth had been something of a test case ever since she had had it knocked out while still at school. Her dentist had made for her the most elaborate and delicate bridge, so that not even she herself would ever have to endure the sight of herself toothless. But the night before last she had fallen downstairs after a party and broken it. She had rung up her dentist in the morning and made a dreadful fuss and a special visit, and he had promised her a temporary plate to last her until he had made her a new elaborate and delicate bridge. And when he had told her the name of the place that she should go to collect the plate, she had noticed in herself a small, hardly noticeable flicker of recollection. He went on explaining to her, obliging yet irritable, "You've got that, then, Mrs. Harvey, 82 St. Luke Street? You go to Old Street Station, then turn right?" And she heard herself saying, "Oh, yes, St. Luke Street, that's just off Tunstall Square." As though anybody might be expected to know about Tunstall Square. And he had agreed, without surprise, about its proximity to Tunstall Square, and then had continued to explain to her about the fact that he was doing her a special favor, and that she should suitably express her gratitude to the man at the works, in view of the shortness of the notice, and she had duly expressed it to the man at the works when he had handed her, 10 minutes ago, her tooth, all wrapped up somewhat brutally, she thought, in a brown paper bag. She had been effusive in her gratitude, and the man had looked at her blankly and said, "Oh, that was quite all right, no trouble at all." And then she had come out and walked along the street, and as she paused at the cafe door, she knew that she had been thinking of him and of that other year all the time, that she could not very well have avoided the thought of him amongst so much familiar scenery. There they had sat in the car and kissed and endlessly discussed the impossibility of kissing. There they had stood by that lamp-post, transfixed, unable to move. The pavement seemed still to bear the marks of their feet, and yet it was all so long ago, so thoroughly slaughtered and decayed. She did not care at all. It was 2 years since she had cared, more than 2 years since she had suffered more for the loss of him than for the old tedium of her life, and the old anxieties which had existed before him and which would exist forever. Because they were what she was made of, inadequacy, loneliness, panic, vanity, decay. These words she said to herself because words consoled her. Though she was not unhappy, she was content, she was occupied, she had got her tooth back, everything was under control, the evening would be fine, now that the horror and strain of pretending not to mind that one had a tooth missing had been so successfully averted. She had even quite enjoyed going to that odd place where they made teeth. It was the kind of place that she enjoyed seeing, and she would even be able to tell people about her panic about her tooth, now that the real panic was truly over. And perhaps in a way it made her almost happy, even a little happier than usual, to be back in this place, to find how thoroughly dead it all was, how most efficiently she had died. She saw no ghosts of him here. For a year after their parting she had seen him on every street corner, in every passing car, in shapes of head and hand and forms of movement, but now he was nowhere any more, not even here. For as long as she had imagined that she saw him, she had imagined that he had remembered, that those false ghosts had been in some way the projected shadows of his love, but now she knew that surely they had both forgotten. Remembering him, she thought that this was what she knew. She pushed open the door and went in. It looked the same. Nothing had changed. She realized that she had been imagining that it must look different, had been preparing herself for heaven knows what ugly transformations and redecorations, but it looked the same. The sameness of it made her pause, took her breath away, though even as she stood there she said to herself, "How foolish to imagine it takes my breath away, for I am breathing quite regularly, quite normally. It is simply that I have become, for an instant, aware of the fact that I am breathing." She went to the side of the room that they had always favored, the wall side, away from the door and the window, and sat on the corner table where they'd always sat when they could, with her back to the door. She sat there and looked down at the red-veined formica tabletop, with its cluster of salt pot, pepper pot, mustard pot, sauce bottle, and ashtray. The salt pot was of thick-ribbed perspex, and she remembered the exact common mounting scallops of its edges. She took it in her hand and felt it. She did not often now lunch in places where such objects might be found. Then she looked up at the dark yellow ceiling, with its curiously useless trellis-work hung with plastic lemons and bananas, and then at the wall papered as before in a strange, delicate, dirty, flowered print, with paper badly cut and joining badly at the seams and broken up by protruding, obsolescent, functionless bits of woodwork dating from former decorative schemes. On the wall hung the only thing that was different. It was a calendar, a gift from a garage, and the picture showed an alpine hut in snowy mountains, for all that the month was May. In their day, the calendar had been one donated by a fruit juice firm, and they had seen it through three seasons. She recalled the anguish with which she had seen its leaves turn, more relentless even than those leaves falling so dreadfully and ominously from more natural trees, and she recalled the appalling photograph of their parting, which had portrayed an autumn evening in the country garden, with an old couple sitting by their creeper-covered door. They had both been insatiable, merciless deliverers of ultimatums, the one upon the other, and she had selected in her own soul this month and one day of this month, the 23rd, she knew it even now, the 23rd, for her final, last, unalterable decision, and she had watched it come up upon them. She had sat at this table, or perhaps, after all, not at this one, but at the one next to it, and she had said, Look, that's it. On the 23rd, that's it, and I mean it this time. She wondered if he had known that she meant it, whether an indefinable resolution in her, so small that she did not herself trust it, had somehow communicated itself to him, so that he had known that, for this one last time, it was for real. Because he had taken her at her word. It was the first time that she had not relented, nor he persisted. Each other time he had left her forever, a phone call had been enough to regain him, and each time she had left him she had sat by the telephone biting her nails and waiting for it to ring. But this time he did not ring, and after a couple of days she ceased to leave the receiver off when nobody was looking. She said to herself from time to time, perhaps in those 2 days he rang and rang repeatedly, rang every hour and found me perpetually engaged, and knew what I had done, and knew that at last I meant what I had said, but she knew that she would never, never know, and that for her it was all the same if he once rung, or 20 times, or never even tried. It had happened, after so many false attempts, it had finally happened. Preparations for death had been, in a way, like death itself, and she supposed that was why they must so incessantly have made them more merciful to each other than they knew, for the experience of losing him, so often endured in imagination, had solidified from imagination into reality so slowly, with such obdurate slow accretions, that there was no point at which she said, "Look, it is done and done for good." There had always seemed a point at which it might be undone, but not now, not now. She looked at the snowy hut upon the wall, at the icy mountains and the frozen glaciers, and she thought, "Ah, well, there was a point at which I feared we did not have it in us to part," and a kind of admiration for her past self possessed her, a respect for a woman who had been so thoroughly capable of so sizable a renunciation. The menu, when it was brought to her, had not altered much. She was glad of this, for without her glasses she doubted whether she would have made much of its faded violet over-duplicated manuscript, though she never knew why she bothered to read menus, for she always, with unfailing regularity, wherever she was, ate the same lunch. She always had cheese omelet and chips. So she ordered her meal and then sat back to wait. Usually, whenever left alone in a public place, she would read, and through habit she propped her book up against the sauce bottle and rested her eyes upon it, but she did not look at the words. Nor was she dwelling entirely upon the past, for a certain pleasurable anxiety about her evening's engagement was stealing most of her attention, and she found herself wondering whether she had adequately prepared her piece, and whether David Rathbone would offer to drive her home, and whether her hair would look all right. For the last time she'd been on the television, there had been a girl in the makeup place who had messed it about dreadfully and cut bits off her fringe and generally made her look like some quite other kind of person. And most of all, she wondered if she ought to wear her gray skirt. She was really worried about the gray skirt question. All the anxiety that had previously attached itself to the importance of getting her tooth in time had now transferred itself to the skirt. For although she liked it very much, she was not at all sure that it was not just a very, very little bit tight. If it wasn't, then it was perfect, for it was the kind of thing that she always looked marvelous in. But just supposing that it was, there was nobody in the whole world who could tell her, who could decide for her this delicate point. She had even asked her husband about it the night before, and he had looked at it and nodded his head and said it looked lovely, and she knew exactly how much and how little that meant. There was nobody but herself with the finesse, with the information to decide such a point, and she could not decide. And she was just saying to herself, "The very fact that I'm worrying about it must mean that it must be too tight after all, or the thought of it being too tight wouldn't have crossed my mind, would it?" when she saw him. What was really most shocking about it was the way that they noticed each other at exactly the same moment, simultaneously, without a chance of turning away or in any way managing the shock. They were both such managers, but this time they had not a chance. Their eyes met and they both jerked, beyond hope of dissimulation. "Oh, Christ," he said after a second or two, and stood there and went on looking at her. And she felt at such a loss, sitting there with her book propped up against the tomato ketchup and her head full of skirts and false teeth, and she said, hurriedly, throwing away what might, after all, to such as her, have been really quite a moment, Oh, Lord, oh, well, since you're here, do sit down. I mean, you might as well sit down. And she moved up the small two-seater bench, pushing her bag along, losing a shoe, for she'd kicked them off under the table, inelegantly dragging her jacket out of his way, closing up her book with a rapid snap, averting her eyes, confused, deprecating, unable to look. And he sat down by her, and then said quite suddenly and intimately, as though perfectly at home with her after so many years of silence, as though perfectly confident that she would share whatever he might have to think or say, "Oh, Lord, my darling, what a dreadful, dreadful surprise. I don't think I shall ever, ever recover." "Oh, I don't know," she said, as though she too had discovered exactly where she was. "Oh, I don't know. One gets over these things quite quickly. I feel better already, don't you?" "Why, yes, I suppose I do," he said. "I feel better now. I'm sitting down. Thought I was going to faint standing there and looking at you." "Well," she said, "it wasn't quite a fair test of me, was it? Because, after all, I was sitting down already. I mean, nobody ever fainted sitting down, surely." "Oh, I'm sure it has been done," he said. "If you'd fainted, I'd have had to put your head between your knees. And God knows how we'd have managed that at one of these tables. I'd forgotten how cramped it all was. But we used to like that, I suppose, didn't we?" "Yes, I suppose we did," she said. "Even though you didn't faint," he said, "didn't you feel some sort of slight tremor? Surely you must have done." "It's hard to tell," she said, "when one's sitting down. It isn't a fair test, even of tremors." "No," he said, "no." Then they were silent for a moment or two. Then she said, very precisely and carefully, offering her first generous signal of intended retreat, "I suppose that what is odd, really, is that we haven't come across one another before." "Oh, I don't know," he said, with equal disappointing neutrality. "Where would we have met? It's not as though we ever belonged to what you might call the same world." "No," she said, "no, I suppose not." "Have you ever been back here before?" he asked. "No, never," she said. "Have you?" "Yes," he said. "Yes, I have. And if you had been back, you might have seen me. I looked for you." "You're lying," she said quickly, elated, looking at him for the first time since he had sat down by her, and then looking away quickly, horrified by the dangerous and appalling proximity of his head, but keeping nevertheless her nerve, being more or less sure that he was in fact lying. "No, I'm not," he said. "I came here and looked for you. I was sure that you would come." "It's a safe lie," she said, "like all your lies, a lie I could never catch you out in, unless I really had been here looking for you and simply hadn't wanted to admit it." "And even then," he said, "we might merely have missed each other." "Yes," she conceded. "But," he said with conviction, "you weren't here at all. I know you weren't here. I was here, I came, but you didn't. You were faithless, weren't you, my darling?" "Faithless? You forgot me quicker than I forgot you, didn't you? When you had so promised to remember." "Oh," she said, wondering if she should admit so much, but unable to resist the ominous luxury of admission. "Oh, I didn't forget you." "Didn't you? How long did you remember me for?" "Oh, how can one say," she said. "After all, there are degrees of remembrance." "Tell me," he said, "tell me. What harm can it do to tell me now?" She moved a little on the seat away from him, but settling at the same time into a more comfortable pose of confidence, because she wanted to tell him. She had been waiting for years to tell him. "I suffered quite horribly," she said, "really quite horribly. That's what you want to hear, isn't it?" "Of course it is," he said. "Oh, I really did," she said. "I can't tell you. I cried all the time for weeks, for a month, for at least a month. And whenever the phone went, I started. I jumped like a fool as though I'd been shot. It was pathetic. It was ludicrous. In the end, I had to invent some bloody silly story about waiting for a call about a job, though what job could ever have got anyone in such a state, I can hardly imagine. And each time I answered and it wasn't you, I could hardly speak. I could somehow hardly make the effort to speak. It's odd how people don't notice when one doesn't reply. I would stand there listening, and they would go on talking, and sometimes I would say yes or no, as I waited for them to ring off, and when they did ring off, I don't think they'd even noticed, and then I would sit down and cry. Is that what you want me to say?" "I want to hear it," he said, "but it can't be true." "It's as true as that you came to this place to look for me," she said. "I did come," he said. "And I did weep," she said. "Did you ever try to ring me?" he asked then, unable to resist. No, she said with some pride. No, not once. I never tried, not once. I said I wouldn't, and I didn't. I rang you once, he said. You didn't, she said, you didn't, and became aware at that instant that her knees under the table were trembling. They were, quite unmistakably. I did, he said. It was just over a year ago, and we'd just got back from a party, about 3 in the morning it was, and I rang you. But you didn't answer. He answered. Oh, God, she said. Oh, God, it's true, it's true. It's not a lie, because I remember it. Oliver said it was burglars, a Friday night. Wasn't it a Friday night? Yes, he said. My darling, darling, it was. Did you know it might have been me? I didn't think it could have been you, she said. Not you after so long a time. But I thought of you. When the phone rang and woke us, I thought of you. And when Oliver said there was no answer, I thought of you. Oh, my darling, I can't tell you how I've had to stop myself ringing you, how I've sat there by the phone and lifted the receiver and dialed the first numbers of your number, and then stopped and not let myself do it. And the receiver would be dripping with sweat when I put it down. But I stopped myself. I did stop myself. That was good of me, wasn't it? Oh, he said, if you knew how I'd wanted you to ring. I did write to you once, she said, but I couldn't bring myself to post it. But I'll tell you what I did. I typed out an envelope to you, and I put one of those circulars from that absurd poetry club of mine into it, and I sent it off to you because I thought that at least it might create in you a passing thought of me. And I liked the thought of something from my house reaching your house, though perhaps she threw it away before it even got to you. I remember it, he said. I did think of you, but I didn't think you sent it because the postmark was Croydon. Oh, she said weakly, you got it. You did get it. Oh, Lord, how alarmingly faithful we have both been. Did you expect us not to be? We swore that we would be. Oh, look, my darling, here's your lunch. Are you still eating cheese omelets every day? Now, that really is what I call alarming consistency, and I haven't even ordered. What shall I have? What about some moussaka? I always used to like that, and it was always rather nice in its own disgusting way. One moussaka, please. I like cheese omelets, she said, and after all, I don't see why one shouldn't have the same lunch every day. I mean, most people always have the same breakfast, don't they? Nobody complains when people go on eating toast and marmalade, do they? I wasn't complaining, he said. I was just remarking. I like your habits. I always did. You don't think I've changed, do you? How should I know, she said, and ate her first mouthful. Then she put down her knife and fork and said reflectively, you know, from my point of view, at least, the whole business was quite unnecessary. What I mean is, Oliver hadn't the faintest suspicion. The thought of you had never even crossed his mind, which, considering how ludicrously careless we were, is quite astonishing. We could have carried on forever, and he'd have never known. He was far too preoccupied himself with his own affairs to notice. I got it all out of him in the end, and I forgave him very nicely. And do you know what he said at the end of it all, at the end of all my forgiveness? He said he'd had his suspicions that I'd been carrying on at the time with Robert Bennington. Have you ever heard of such a thing? I was so horrified by the very idea that I flew into a terrible rage and defended myself so vehemently that I quite frightened him. I mean to say, Robert, what a choice that would have been. What a ghastly mistake that would have been. I was never so offended in my life. What a pleasure it was, all that virtuous indignation. It was like getting rid of 3 years' guilt. I can't tell you what a relief it was. Robert Bennington, he said. Robert Bennington. Who was he? Was he that tall fellow in films with that fat wife? Oh, she said, he's nobody, just nobody. I mean, he's quite nice, but as for anyone thinking him more than quite nice. And she noticed as she spoke that her voice had taken on somehow, as with age-old habit, those provocative, defensive tones in which they would always discuss others, other people, the stray characters with which they would decorate from time to time their charmed and passionate dialogue, and she knew that he, in reply, would use that note of confident and yet in some way truly dreadfully suspicious jealousy. "I seem to remember," he said, "sure enough, that Robert Bennington took you out to the cinema one evening when Oliver was in Ireland. That was him, wasn't it?" "You remember everything," she said. "And you said that you thought of me when you were in the cinema, but you didn't. I know you didn't," he said. Oh, I did, she protested. I thought of you everywhere, and what better place to think of you than in the cinema, especially when with a dull fellow like Robert. I thought you said he was quite nice, he said, and she started to say, yes, he is quite nice, and then instead she started to laugh and said, you are absurd, darling. It was Oliver that introduced that Robert motif. There's no need for you to start on it, especially so long after the event. I mean, any concern you might now feel would be well and truly irrelevant. After what event? He said, incurable. No event. There wasn't any event, she said. The whole point of the story was that Oliver had got it so wrong, so pointlessly wrong. I mean, suspecting Robert instead of you. It's no good, he said, whatever you say. I simply can't prevent myself feeling annoyed that anyone might have had any reason for thinking that you were in love with anyone but me. And then the word love being mentioned, that final syllable, they were both reduced to silence. And they sat there, still, in their ridiculous proximity, until she managed to take another mouthful of her omelet. You know, he said, when the movement of her jaws had sufficiently disrupted the connection, all those continual threats of separation, that was really corrupt, you know. That was as bad as nagging. I feel bad about it now, looking back. Don't you? How do you mean, bad about it, she said. I feel we ought to have been able to do better than that. Though, come to think of it, it was you who did nearly all the threatening. Every time I saw you, you said it was for the last time. Every time. And I must have seen you 6 days in every week for over a year. You can't have meant it each time. I did mean it, she said. I did mean it. Though each time I stopped meaning it and fixed up the next time to see you, I felt that of course I hadn't meant it. By then, again, I did mean it, because I finally did it, didn't I? You mean we did it, he said. You couldn't have done it without my help. If I had rung you, if I'd written you, it would have started all over again. Do you really think so, she said sadly, without malice, without recrimination. Yes, I suppose you might be right. I could never decide whether I could do it on my own or not. Evidently I couldn't. It takes two to part, just as it takes two to love. It was corrupt, though, he said, to make ourselves live under that perpetual threat. Yes, she said, but remember how lovely it was, how horribly lovely each time that one relented. Each time one said, I'll never see you again. All right, I'll meet you tomorrow in the usual place at 1:30. It was lovely. Lovely, but wicked, he said. Oh, that sensation, she said, that sensation of defeat, that was so lovely, every time you touched me, every time I saw you. And I felt so sure, so entirely sure, that what you felt was what I felt, that you were as weak as me, and as capable of enduring such ghastly self-inflicted wounds. Lord, we were so alike, and to think that when I first knew you I couldn't think of anything to say to you at all. I thought you came from another world, that we had nothing in common at all, nothing at all except, well, except you know what. I feel it would be dangerous even to mention it, even now. Oh, darling, what a disaster, our being so alike. It was that that made it so hard, he said. The reverse of the irresistible force and unbreakable object principle, whatever that might be. Two objects most infinitely breakable, perhaps, she said. I liked it, though, he said. I liked it, breaking up together. Better than having it done to one, better than doing it. Better? Perhaps even after all, less corrupt, he said. Yes, but more seriously incurable, she said. And silence threatening to fall once more, she said quickly. Anyway, tell me what you're doing round here. I mean to say, one has to have some reason for coming to a place like this. I told you, he said, I was looking for you. You are a liar, she said, smiling, amazed that she still, even here, could allow herself to be amused. Indeed, could not prevent herself from smiling. What are you doing here, then, he said. Oh, I had a perfectly good reason, she said. Perfectly good, though rather embarrassing. I don't know if I'll tell you, but I suppose I will. You know that false front tooth? Well, yesterday morning I lost it, and I've got to be on a television thing tonight. And the thought of being without a tooth was so alarming, so I went to my dentist, and he made them make me a new one, and I had to come round here to the warehouse to pick it up. Have you got it in? Yes, she said, and turned to face him, smiling, lifting her upper lip. Look, there it is. Do you mean, he said, that if you'd had lunch before collecting your tooth, I would at least have seen you without it in? Theoretically, she said, but it wouldn't in fact have been possible, because how could I ever have had my lunch in a public place without my front tooth? I'd hardly call this a public place, he said. What a vain woman you are. You always were. I don't see anything wrong with vanity, she said. And look, if you really want to see me without my tooth, there you are. And she took it out and turned to him and showed him. You look lovely, he said. You look like a school child. You look like my daughter. She's got three missing at the moment. You still haven't told me what you're doing here, she said, putting her plate back again. I bet you haven't got as good a reason as me. Mine is entirely convincing, don't you think? I mean, where else could I have lunch? I think my reason clears me entirely of any suspicion of any kind, don't you? Any suspicion of sentiment? That's what I meant. He thought for a moment and then said, I had to call on a man about my income tax. Look, here's his address. And he got an envelope out of his pocket and showed her. Ah, she said. You see, he said. See what? She said. I came here on purpose, he said, to think of you. I could have had lunch at lots of places between London Wall and here. Yes, I suppose so, she said, but you always were rather conservative about eating places. Suspicious, almost. You didn't come here because of me. You came here because it's the only place you know about. It comes to the same thing, he said. No, it doesn't, she said firmly. She felt creeping upon her the familiar illusion of control, created as always before by a concentration upon trivialities, which could no longer, even momentarily, disguise the gravity of any outcome. And she reflected that their conversations had always so closely followed the patterns of their dialogues in bed, and that these idle points of concentration were like those frivolous delaying gestures in which she would turn aside, in which he would lie still and stare at the ceiling, hardly touching her, not daring, as he said, to touch her, and thus merely deferring, in their own studiously developed amorous dialectic, the inevitable, and thinking this, and able to live only in the deferment. For now there was no inevitability, no outcome she could see, she said, eating her last chip. And how are your children? They're fine, he said, fine. Saul got into grammar school and starts next year. We were pleased about it. What about yours? Oh, they're all right, too. I've had some dreadful nights with Laura recently. I must say, I thought I was through with all that. I mean, the child's five now, but she says she can't sleep and has these dreadful nightmares. So she's been every night in my bed for the last fortnight. It's wearing me out. Then in the morning she just laughs, and then at night it starts all over again. She doesn't kick. She's not as bony and awful as Fred used to be. It's just that I can't sleep with anyone else in the bed. What does Oliver say? He asked, and she said without thinking, having said it so often to others, Oh, I don't sleep with Oliver any more. And realizing as she said it precisely what she had said, wondering how she could have made such a mistake, and wondering how to get out of it. But fortunately, at that instant his moussaka arrived, and the depositing of the plate and the redeployment of cutlery made it unnecessary to pursue the subject. Though once it had become unnecessary, she regretted the subject's disappearance, and she thought of saying that was no less than the truth. What was the truth itself? She thought of saying that she had slept with nobody since she had slept with him, that for 3 years she had slept alone and was quite prepared to sleep alone forever. But she was not sure, not entirely sure, that he would want to hear it, and she knew that such a remark once made could never be retracted, so she said nothing. He stared at his moussaka, at the browned yellow crust. It looks all right, he said, and took a mouthful and chewed it, and then he put his fork down and said, oh, Lord, what a Proustian experience! I can't believe it. I can't believe that I'm sitting here with you. It tastes of you, that stuff. Oh, God, it reminds me of you. You look so beautiful. You look so lovely, my darling. Oh, God, I loved you so much. I really loved you. Do you believe me that I really loved you? I haven't slept with anyone, she said, since I last slept with you. Oh, darling, he said, and she could feel herself fainting and sighing away, drifting downwards on that fatefully descending, eddying spiral, like Paolo and Francesca in hell, helpless, the mutually entwined, drifting fall of all true lovers, unresisting, finally unresisting, as though 3 years of solitude had been nothing but a pause, nothing but a long breath before this final acknowledgment of nature, damnation, and destiny. She turned towards him and said, "Oh, my darling, I love you. What can I do? I love you." And he, with the same breath, said, "I love you. I all the time love you. I want you." And they kissed there, their faces already so close that little inclination was needed. They kissed there above the moussaka and chips, because they believed in such things. Because that was what they believed in. Because, like disastrous romantics, they habitually connived with fate by remembering the names of restaurants and the streets they had once walked along as lovers. "Those who forget, forget," he said to her later, "and those who do not forget will meet again." And that story was The Reunion by Margaret Drabble from Treasury of Great Short Stories, published by Amaranth Press. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. Idiots First by Bernard Malamud. The thick ticking of the tin clock stopped. Mendel, dozing in the dark, awoke in fright. The pain returned as he listened. He drew on his cold, embittered clothing and wasted minutes sitting at the edge of his bed. "Isaac," he ultimately sighed. In the kitchen, Isaac, his astonished mouth open, held 6 peanuts in his palm. He placed each on the table. 1, 2, 9. He gathered each peanut and appeared in the doorway. Mendel, in loose hat and long overcoat, still sat on the bed. Isaac watched with small eyes and ears, thick hair graying the sides of his head. "Schlaf," he nasally said. "No," muttered Mendel. As if stifling, he rose. "Come, Isaac." He wound his old watch, though the sight of the stopped clock nauseated him. Isaac wanted to hold it to his ear. "No, it's late." Mendel put the watch carefully away. In the drawer he found the little paper bag of crumbled ones and fives and slipped it into his overcoat pocket. He helped Isaac on with his coat. Isaac looked at one dark window, then at the other. Mendel stared at both blank windows. They went slowly down the darkly lit stairs, Mendel first, Isaac watching the moving shadows on the wall. To one long shadow he offered a peanut. "Hungrig." In the vestibule the old man gazed through the thin glass. The November night was cold and bleak. Opening the door, he cautiously thrust his head out. Though he saw nothing, he quickly shut the door. "Ginsburg, that he came to see me yesterday," he whispered in Isaac's ear. Isaac sucked air. "You know who I mean?" Isaac combed his chin with his fingers. "That's the one with the black whiskers. Don't talk to him or go with him if he asks you." Isaac moaned. "Young people, he don't bother so much," Mendel said in afterthought. It was supper time, and the street was empty, but the store windows dimly lit their way to the corner. They crossed the deserted street and went on. Isaac, with a happy cry, pointed to the 3 golden balls. Mendel smiled, but was exhausted when they got to the pawn shop. The pawnbroker, a red-bearded man with black horn-rimmed glasses, was eating a whitefish at the rear of the store. He craned his head and saw them and settled back to sip his tea. In 5 minutes he came forward, patting his shapeless lips with a large white handkerchief. Mendel, breathing heavily, handed him the worn gold watch. The pawnbroker, raising his glasses, screwed in his eyepiece. He turned the watch over once. $8. The dying man wet his cracked lips. "I must have 35. So go to Rothschild." "Cost me myself 60. In 1905. The pawnbroker handed back the watch. It had stopped ticking. Mendel wound it slowly. It ticked hollowly. "Isaac must go to my uncle, that he lives in California." "It's a free country," said the pawnbroker. Isaac, watching a banjo, snickered. "What's the matter with him?" the pawnbroker asked. "So let be $8, muttered Mendel, "but where will I get the rest till tonight?" "How much for my hat and coat?" he asked. "No sale." The pawnbroker went behind the cage and wrote out a ticket. He locked the watch in a small drawer, but Mendel still heard it ticking. In the street he slipped the $8 into the paper bag, then searched in his pockets for a scrap of writing. Finding it, he strained to read the address by the light of the street lamp. As they trudged to the subway, Mendel pointed to the sprinkled sky. "Isaac, look how many stars are tonight." "Eggs," said Isaac. "First we will go to Mr. Fishbean, after we will eat." They got off the train in Upper Manhattan and had to walk several blocks before they located Fishbean's house. "A regular palace," Mendel murmured, looking forward to a moment's warmth. Isaac stared uneasily at the heavy door of the house. Mendel rang. The servant, a man with long sideburns, came to the door and said Mr. and Mrs. Fishbean were dining and could see no one. He should eat in peace, but we will wait until he finishes. Come back tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning Mr. Fishbean will talk to you. He don't do business or charity at this time of night. Charity, I'm not interested. Come back tomorrow. Tell him it's life or death. Whose life or death? So if not his, then mine. Don't be such a big smart aleck. Look me in my face, said Mendel, and tell me if I got time till tomorrow morning. The servant stared at him, then at Isaac, and reluctantly let them in. The foyer was a vast, high-ceilinged room with many oil paintings on the walls, voluminous silken draperies, a thick flowered rug at foot, and a marble staircase. Mr. Fishbean, a paunchy, bald-headed man with hairy nostrils and small patent leather feet, ran lightly down the stairs, a large napkin tucked under a tuxedo coat button. He stopped on the fifth step from the bottom and examined his visitors. Who comes on Friday night to a man that he has guests to spoil him his supper? Excuse me that I bother you, Mr. Fishbean, Mendel said. If I didn't come now, I couldn't come tomorrow. Without more preliminaries, please state your business. I'm a hungry man.
Hungry,
wailed Isaac. Fishbean adjusted his pince-nez. What's the matter with him? This is my son Isaac. He is like this all his life. Isaac mewled. I am sending him to California. Mr. Fishbean don't contribute to personal pleasure trips. I'm a sick man, and he must go tonight on the train to my Uncle Leo. I never give to unorganized charity, Fishbean said, but if you are hungry, I will invite you downstairs in my kitchen. We're having tonight chicken with stuffed derma. All I ask is $35 for the train ticket to my uncle in California. I have already the rest. Who is your uncle? How old a man? 81 years, a long life to him. Fishbean burst into laughter. 81 years and you're sending him this half-wit? Mendel, flailing both arms, cried, Please, without names. Fishbean politely conceded. Where is open the door there? We go in the house, the sick man said. If you will kindly give me $35, God will bless you. What is $35 to Mr. Fishbean? Nothing. To me, for my boy, is everything. Fishbean drew himself up to his tallest height. Private contributions I don't make, only to institutions. This is my fixed policy. Mendel sank to his creaking knees on the rug. Please, Mr. Fishbean, if not 35, give maybe 20.
Levinson!
Fishbean angrily called. The servant with the long sideburns appeared at the top of the stairs. Show this party where is the door, unless he wishes to partake food before leaving the premises. For what I got chicken won't cure it, Mendel said. This way, if you please, said Levinson, descending. Isaac assisted his father up. Take him to an institution, Fishbean advised over the marble balustrade. He ran quickly up the stairs, and they were at once outside, buffeted by winds. The walk to the subway was tedious. The wind blew mournfully. Mendel, breathless, glanced furtively at shadows. Isaac, clutching his peanuts in his frozen fist, clung to his father's side. They entered a small park to rest for a minute on a stone bench under a leafless two-branched tree. The thick right branch was raised, the thin left one hung down. A very pale moon rose slowly. So did a stranger as they approached the bench.
Gott Yuntif, he said hoarsely.
Mendel, drained of blood, waved his wasted arms. Isaac yowled sickly. Then a bell chimed, and it was only 10. Mendel let out a piercing, anguished cry as the bearded stranger disappeared into the bushes. A policeman came running, and though he beat the bushes with his nightstick, could turn up nothing. Mendel and Isaac hurried out of the little park. When Mendel glanced back, the dead tree had its thin arm raised, the thick one down. He moaned. They boarded a trolley, stopping at the home of a former friend, but he had died years ago. On the same block they went into a cafeteria and ordered 2 fried eggs for Isaac. The tables were crowded except where a heavy-set man sat eating soup with Kasha. After one look at him they left in haste, although Isaac wept. Mendel had another address on a slip of paper, but the house was too far away in Queens, so they stood in a doorway shivering. What can I do, he frantically thought, in 1 short hour? He remembered the furniture in the house. It was junk, but might bring a few dollars. Come, Isaac. They went once more to the pawnbroker's to talk to him, but the shop was dark, and an iron gate, rings and gold watches glinting through it, was drawn tight across his place of business. They huddled behind a telephone pole, both freezing. Isaac whimpered. "See the big moon, Isaac? The whole sky is white." He pointed, but Isaac wouldn't look. Mendel dreamed for a minute of the sky lit up, long sheets of light in all directions. Under the sky in California sat Uncle Leo drinking tea with lemon. Mendel felt warm, but woke up cold. Across the street stood an ancient brick synagogue. He pounded on the huge door, but no one appeared. He waited till he had breath and desperately knocked again. At last there were footsteps within, and the synagogue door creaked open on its massive brass hinges. A darkly dressed sexton holding a dripping candle glared at them. "Who knocks this time of night with so much noise on the synagogue door?" Mendel told the sexton his troubles. "Please, I would like to speak to the rabbi." "The rabbi is an old man. He sleeps now. His wife won't let you see him. Go home and come back tomorrow." "To tomorrow I said goodbye already. I'm a dying man." Though the sexton seemed doubtful, he pointed to an old wooden house next door. "In there he lives." He disappeared into the synagogue with his lit candle casting shadows around him. Mendel, with Isaac clutching his sleeve, went up the wooden steps and rang the bell. After 5 minutes, a big-faced, gray-haired, bulky woman came out on the porch with a torn robe thrown over her nightdress. She emphatically said the rabbi was sleeping and could not be waked. But as she was insisting, the rabbi himself tottered to the door. He listened a minute and said, "Who wants to see me? Let them come in." They entered a cluttered room. The rabbi was an old, skinny man with bent shoulders and a wisp of white beard. He wore a flannel nightgown and a black skull cap. His feet were bare. "Vais mir," his wife muttered. "Put on shoes or tomorrow comes sure pneumonia." She was a woman with a big belly, years younger than her husband. Staring at Isaac, she turned away. Mendel apologetically related his errand. "All I need more is $35. "$35,000, said the rabbi's wife. "Why not $35,000? Who has so much money? My husband is a poor rabbi. The doctors take away every penny." "Dear friend," said the rabbi, "if I had, I would give you." "I got already $70,000, Mendel said, heavy-hearted. "All I need more is $35,000. "God will give you," said the rabbi. "In the grave," said Mendel. "I need tonight. Come, Isaac." "Wait," called the rabbi. He hurried inside, came out with a fur-lined caftan, and handed it to Mendel. "Yasha!" shrieked his wife. "Not your new coat." "I got my old one. Who needs two coats for one body?" "Yasha, I am screaming." "Who can go among poor people, tell me, in a new coat?" "Yasha," she cried, "what can this man do with your coat? He needs tonight the money. The pawnbrokers are asleep." "So let him wake them up." "No." She grabbed the coat from Mendel. He held on to a sleeve, wrestling her for the coat. "Her I know," Mendel thought. "Shylock," he muttered. Her eyes glittered. The rabbi groaned and tottered dizzily. His wife cried out as Mendel yanked the coat from her hands. "Run," cried the rabbi. "Run, Isaac." They ran out of the house and down the steps. "Stop, you thief," called the rabbi's wife. The rabbi pressed both hands to his temples and fell to the floor. "Help!" his wife wept. "Heart attack! Help!" But Mendel and Isaac ran through the streets with the rabbi's new fur-lined caftan. After them noiselessly ran Ginsburg. It was very late when Mendel bought the train ticket in the only booth open. There was no time to stop for a sandwich, so Isaac ate his peanuts and they hurried to the train in the vast deserted station. "So in the morning," Mendel gasped as they ran, "there comes a man that he sells sandwiches and coffee. Eat, but get change. When reaches California, the train will be waiting for you on the station, Uncle Leo. If you don't recognize him, he will recognize you. Tell him I send best regards." But when they arrived at the gate to the platform, it was shut, the light out. Mendel, groaning, beat on the gate with his fists. "Too late," said the uniformed ticket collector, a bulky bearded man with hairy nostrils and a fishy smell. He pointed to the station clock. "Already past 12. "But I see standing there still the train," Mendel said, hopping in his grief. "It just left in one more minute. A minute is enough. Just open the gate." "Too late, I told you." Mendel socked his bony chest with both hands. "With my whole heart I beg you this little favor. Favors you had enough already. For you the train is gone. You should have been dead already at midnight. I told you that yesterday. This is the best I can do."
"Ginsburg!"
Mendel shrank from him.
"Who else?"
The voice was metallic, eyes glittered, the expression amused. "For myself," the old man begged, "I don't ask a thing, but what will happen to my boy?"
Ginsburg shrugged slightly. "What will happen, happens. This isn't my responsibility. I got enough to think about without worrying about somebody on one cylinder."
"What then is your responsibility?"
"To create conditions, to make happen what happens. I ain't in the anthropomorphic business."
"Whatever business you in, where is your pity?"
"This ain't my commodity. The law is the law."
"Which law is this?"
"The cosmic universal law, goddammit, the one I got to follow myself."
"What kind of a law is it?" cried Mendel. "For God's sake, don't you understand what I went through in my life with this poor boy? Look at him. For 39 years since the day he was born, I wait for him to grow up, but he don't. Do you understand what this means in a father's heart? Why don't you let him go to his uncle?"
His voice had risen and he was shouting.
Isaac mewled loudly.
"Better calm down or you'll hurt somebody's feelings," Ginsburg said with a wink toward Isaac.
"All my life," Mendel cried, his body trembling. "What did I have? I was poor. I suffered from my health. When I worked too hard. When I didn't work, was worse. My wife died a young woman, but I didn't ask from anybody nothing. Now I ask a small favor. Be so kind, Mr. Ginsburg."
The ticket collector was picking his teeth with a matchstick.
"You ain't the only one, my friend. Some got it worse than you. That's how it goes in this country."
"You dog, you!"
Mendel lunged at Ginsburg's throat and began to choke. "You bastard, don't you understand what it means, human?" They struggled nose to nose. Ginsburg, though his astonished eyes bulged, began to laugh. "You pipsqueak nothing. I'll freeze you to pieces." His eyes lit in rage, and Mendel felt an unbearable cold like an icy dagger invading his body, all of his parts shriveling. "Now I die without helping Isaac." A crowd gathered. Isaac yelped in fright. Clinging to Ginsburg in his last agony, Mendel saw reflected in the ticket collector's eyes the depth of his terror. But he saw that Ginsburg, staring at himself in Mendel's eyes, saw mirrored in them the extent of his own awful wrath. He beheld a shimmering, starry, blinding light that produced darkness. Ginsburg looked astounded.
"Who, me?"
His grip on the squirming old man slowly loosened, and Mendel, his heart barely beating, slumped to the ground.
"Go," Ginsburg muttered. "Take him to the train."
"Let pass," he commanded a guard. The crowd parted. Isaac helped his father up, and they tottered down the steps to the platform where the train waited, lit and ready to go. Mendel found Isaac a coach seat and hastily embraced him.
"Help Uncle Leo, Ezekiel. Also remember your father and mother."
"Be nice to him," he said to the conductor. "Show him where everything is." He waited on the platform until the train began slowly to move. Isaac sat at the edge of his seat, his face strained in the direction of his journey. When the train was gone, Mendel ascended the stairs to see what had become of Ginsburg. And that story was Idiots First by Bernard Malamud from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The next story is from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. The Artichoke by Marilyn Crissell. Until we take into account his most personal views about the artichoke, the glove, the cookie, or the spool, Breton, Nadja. It will happen on a train to Banff, both of us thinking we're on a vacation. We'll be in the dining car smoking and discussing Baudelaire, or discussing Gulf oil, or discussing inflation while we wait for the waiter. While we wait for the waiter, in no hurry, and not really very hungry. And in this discussion, we'll use the expression GNP and market value and idea of evil. And it will be you and I talking, not someone else somewhere else, and not some fake couple got up for fiction. The waiter comes to take our order. He's black in a white jacket. He'll be black because that's how waiters on trains to Banff are. It's the decision of the railroad to conduct its business in this way. We'll wish he weren't our waiter, but there you are.
and there we will be while the waiter waits as he's paid just enough, but not too much, to do, until I've made my point about Baudelaire and we break off this discussion to order. The tablecloth will be starched white linen, not because we want starched white linen, but because if you take a train to Banff, you get a white linen tablecloth. And we're taking this train through these mountains. The mountains won't be there for us, of course, but they'll be there. And we'll order an artichoke, because we like them. We like them, and there they are on the menu. We know we can change some things, but not others, and we know which ones we can change. When you kick a rock, you break your toe, and now we're hungry. By this time, we've dispensed with the waiter's blackness, the starch and the linen, the mountainous mountains. We've adjusted our feelings about them in this fact. We're also bored with these feelings and insist on hanging around like tedious children who have nothing to do, but mostly we're hungry. And everyone, of course, gets hungry. We can gather together around this point as around a table. Right now, I could easily dispense with high-toned moral phrases and sit down with the chairman of the Board of Golf as long as each of us had an artichoke. Here comes the waiter with a white platter. I see the artichoke's rows of spiked leaves, leaves shaped like feathers, and closer now, rounded to a point like feathers, much closer. And are those feathers coming closer? Those are really feathers. And now my hunger backs all the way up from my belly into my mouth, a heart that wants to fly out and away. It's feathers. It's a feathered headdress. It's a head. And the waiter sets before me the purple head of Quetzalcoatl on a tray. I want to say, no, you've mixed up my order with someone else's. I'm not the one who asked for this. Take it away. But, madam, he says, you ordered it. And I want to say, don't call me madam. But there is Quetzalcoatl's head on my tray. What we ordered isn't what we want. You'd think any fool could see that. We've always assumed our gentle intentions excuse our imperial way of life. But we still haven't got used to a waiter bringing Quetzalcoatl's head on a platter, whose head we'd forgotten we were supposed to ask for, having gone on this vacation through mountains, forested, rugged, amazing, though no longer virgin, leaving the kids in school studying how to manage the corporation, whose managers we'd comfortably managed to forget we are. And that story was The Artichoke by Marilyn Crissell from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio.